Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Law is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is TWiL, This Week in Law with Denise Howell, Episode 43, Please Come to Boston.
This Week in Law is brought to you by Audible. For your free audiobook, visit audiblepodcasts.com/TWiL.
Hello and welcome back to This Week in Law, our first show of 2010, Episode 43. Really excited to be back after the holidays. This is Denise Howell. I'm your host. I'm here today with a great panel of folks to talk about the slew of things in the technology law arena that have been going on since we did our last show. First, I'd like to welcome a newcomer to the show, David O'Brien. David, great to have you on.
Hello, Denise. Great to be here.
David does a podcast called Technically Legal and contributes to the Citizen Media Law Project. Anything else we should know about your background that you want to share with our listeners and viewers?
Well, I'm also an attorney and licensed here to practice in Massachusetts.
Great. Well, we have some fun Massachusetts things to talk about with you later on today. Also back on the show are Colette Vogel. Hi, Colette.
Hi, nice to see you all.
From VogelLaw.com and coming to us from her new office at Microsoft in Redmond.
Yes.
Tell us a bit about your job shift here and what you're going to be doing for Microsoft.
Thanks. Well, I'm actually winding down my law practice, or have wound it down now, and moved in-house to Microsoft's copyright and trade secrets team. And we're, doing sort of analysis of new products and thinking about policy questions and all sorts of things, mostly in the copyright space is where my specialty will be. But there's also obvious trade secret issues that come up from time to time. So, yeah.
So you've done a lot of web-facing work in your practice. Is that going to carry through in the things that you're supervising at Microsoft?
I think so. Definitely. There's a big initiative that's not, I think it's clear from what some of the things that Steve Ballmer has been saying about moving things to the cloud and sort of cloud computing. And so there's a lot of issues that come up there, not just with security, but also with copyright and trade secret issues. So I think we'll see some of that. But there's also just a lot of products that this company has and I'm still learning about. And, every deal that comes through ends up potentially having implications that deal with copyright and fair use and both on the enforcement side and on the defensive side. So it's going to be an interesting, challenging environment, I think.
Wonderful. Well, we look forward to your insights there from Redmond. And Evan Brown is back with us too. Thanks, Evan, for coming back on the show. Welcome.
Well, thanks for having me. It's great to be back. And I guess, even though we're halfway in the month, it's still not too late to wish you Happy New Year since it's the first show in 2010. So,
I feel like I'm still just coming right out of the holidays. So,
right. I know what you mean. It takes a while to get adjusted and, working on it as, best as we can here. But yeah, I've really been looking forward to this show. It seems like, even though it's been a long time since we've done a show, it was actually before Christmas. There's just such a slew of things happening, a lot of really cool things to talk about today. So I'm really happy to be here.
Me too. And Evan writes regularly about those sorts of things at internetcases.com, so you can catch up with his off-the-show thoughts there. But while we're on the show, let's jump right into this Prop 8 trial that is going on here in California and the controversy about whether it was going to be broadcast on YouTube. To give folks a little bit of background, it's been quite a convoluted process. And yet the second trial on the issue of gay marriage in California, but the first one in federal court that is head-on challenging the constitutionality of a ballot initiative that was passed here not too long ago. That outlawed gay marriage in the state. So that ballot initiative is now being taken up in federal court. with some very high profile lawyers. The venue is San Francisco. David Boies and Theodore Olson, who were opponents in the Bush versus Gore litigation that wound up in the Supreme Court of the United States, are both representing the side challenging the constitutionality of the initiative. And the trial judge in the case wanted to go ahead and put this these trial proceedings in a pilot program that would have broadcast them. Now, federal courts are real reticent to broadcast their proceedings, but they did have a pilot program in the Ninth Circuit, and he tried to put this case into that pilot program and was actually going to put everything out live or near live on YouTube. And that was prevented and blocked by the Supreme Court. So unless you're in San Francisco in the courtroom, you're not seeing these proceedings live. So there is, however, one close to real-time source for catching up on these proceedings, and he's a reporter for the Daily Journal up in San Francisco, and he's on Twitter going ahead and putting out dispatches via that channel. He is Fed Court Junkie on Twitter, if folks want to follow that. So I wanted to get your take on, first of all, let's start with David, since this has a citizen media overtone to it, and get your take on the broadcast of federal trials and real-time dispatches from the court. What do you think of all this?
Well, this is definitely a very interesting case. And I guess it was a little surprising, sort of in terms of the speed of how fast that the district court wanted to get this rule changed in the district court. And unsurprisingly, I guess, they were shot down after they didn't quite follow the rules of how you're supposed to modify the local rules in the district court. And that being that you're supposed to have a period for public comment. And they basically put up the rule, and they did this just a few days before the trial was supposed to start this week. And of course, as you might imagine, some of the parties were not quite too happy about it. So they filed this motion before the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court came right in and said, oh, well, first they issued the stay, of course. And people were sort of, I think most people were pretty curious to see what was going to happen after the stay was issued. But it appears that they probably already had their minds made up by the time they'd issued the stay and, of course, eventually came back and overturned the rule.
Right. And what do you think about this reporter who's putting out the Twitter dispatches? Is that an end run around the prohibition on broadcasting?
Possibly. I mean, this is something that we've worked on before at the Citizen Media Law Project. Just about a month or two ago, we came out with our live blogging and tweeting guide for when you go to court. If you want to try to live blog or tweet a proceeding, what are the best ways of doing that? And in the process, actually, I contributed a lot of research into that. And in the process of researching those issues, you know, I learned a lot about the ways in which the federal courts specifically have dealt with this sort of problem of allowing technology into the courtroom. And what it comes down to in the end is that usually you have a local rule which either prohibits entirely electronic devices within the courtroom, or they allow them at the discretion of the trial judge. And here, at least as long as the trial judge has allowed those devices to be present in the courtroom, it's permissible under the local rules. But, you know, I guess it's not quite the same, though, as a broadcast proceeding that might show up either later delayed on YouTube or live that's being displayed in other courtrooms around the country.
Colette, what are your thoughts on this?
Yeah, it's interesting. I was at a conference that was put together by the Northern District of California. It might have actually been involving the Ninth Circuit a few months ago. They just did a few panels one afternoon, and there's some blogging around that. Eric Goldman, I'm sure, has a post around this because he was one of the panelists speaking about sort of blogging in the courts, and then this obviously the question of the broadcasting courtroom activity. And there are really interesting things that came out of it. I mean, I'm sort of on the side of, it would be great to get, this is a public forum. Now we have a way to make it truly public. It's, you know, not to be morbid, but it's kind of like executions, you know, these are supposed to be historically public things that the public comes together and is, you know, either horrified by or in favor of. And so, you know, in some ways that we want to have the courts be open when it doesn't harm, for example, privacy rights. And I can see in, like, you know, issues related to juveniles and maybe some family law proceedings and things like that, that really need to be not broadcast or not put out. And potentially in technology fields, anytime there's sort of a protective order around the disclosure of trade secrets or information like that, we need to really think through those questions. But in general, the idea of allowing the public to see what's really happening in courts might have a number of effects that we can't really know today as we sit here. There are competing interests. There's the turning it into a circus, which at this conference, I recall one of the administrators saying, you know, it's the problem of the trial whose name we shall not say, which is the O.J. Simpson trial, you know, all the debacles that came out of that being, you know, on the, you know, published, you know, contemporaneously on, not online, but being broadcast. And then there are sort of the real life things, like if these trials and if courtroom proceedings, the average daily oral argument were just available on sort of a C-SPAN like tool, you know, we might have a lot of people realize how boring practice of law can really be and how not exciting and how most of the things that happen in the courtrooms are very sort of mundane procedural things that need to be done and are done for due process purposes and otherwise. But it would really shed a light on what this mysterious world of law and courts and, you know, what goes on in, you know, but in those giant buildings that exist in every single city in the country. I think that that is a really interesting thing. And I think the public would really benefit. And let's find a way, find a
by
path
being put to sleep.
Right. Yeah. I mean, they might be put to sleep, but there may be, you know, it's kind of like getting the insight into the legislative process. It's a real mystery for most people, and myself included. I mean, I spent a teeny tiny time in D.C., but I never worked on the Hill. And, you know, you just learn so much from some exposure to what really happens that it could really change the way we perceive the judicial system and the way we perceive judges and lawyers and, you know, defendant, you know, public defenders and prosecutors and the jury. And I don't know. It's just so unknown what would really come out of this. But I have sort of faith in the people that we will find a lot of really interesting things and we'll learn and grow and develop better systems from it in the long run.
It's interesting to me that there's such a divide between the take on this from state courts who seem to be edging toward the broadcast model. We got an email earlier this month from a listener, Judge David W. Nelson in North Dakota, who let us know that their oral arguments in Supreme Court there have been live webcast for years. Also, the California Supreme Court does its bit to, it actually takes high profile cases and makes sure that they get special treatment and that they're made more public than other cases because of the interest level in them. That was one of the big arguments for blocking the broadcast of this case. It was that supposedly the witnesses for the protect marriage side of things, the anti-gay marriage folks, were being threatened and harassed, and they thought that somehow that would increase by making this more public, which struck me as kind of ironic because they're actually in the situation of having the views and opinions that are carrying force of law in California right now, yet they're the ones who don't want to have their identities be more widely known than they otherwise would be. And by the way, that's an important point too. I mean, they're publicly testifying in court, which is a public forum and which will be reported on by newspapers. There's no kind of seal on these proceedings. So it's not as though everything they're saying isn't already public. It's just making it more public by broadcasting it. Evan, do you have any thoughts on this?
I do. The overarching thing in my mind on this is that it's a little bit, it's quite unfortunate that the whole situation, I believe, has gotten botched. If we look at what the Supreme Court says, I mean, they make it very clear right out of the gate in the majority opinion, and I guess that Justice Breyer's dissent says this as well. You know, the Supreme Court is not saying anything about the merits of the question as to whether there should be live broadcast of court proceedings. And what the basis, as we've, you know, talked about already in this conversation, the basis of the Supreme Court's decision to issue the stay was a procedural one, namely that the district court in collaboration with the Ninth Circuit, Judge Kaczynski, you know, didn't follow the statute from Title 28 that talks about amending the local rule. So I think that it's unfortunate that the question has been put into to issue here, you know, that it's on the table for us to discuss. And there's a certain sense that the answer that we've gotten is a little bit tainted. It's weird to me, and I find it hard to believe that it's just merely a coincidence that the Supreme Court's 5-4 decision split right down the same kind of lines that they would probably split if the question of the constitutionality of a prohibition on gay marriage, was presented to the court. You know, it was, you know, who was it? It was Justice Breyer wrote the dissent. He was joined by Stevens, Ginsburg, and Sotomayor. And so who does that leave? You know, they're writing the per curiam, or the opinion by the court. The majority opinion was, well, you know, you got Roberts, Thomas, Scalia, Alito, and then the swing vote, Kennedy. So I just think it's unfortunate, and it's a little bit scary, perhaps, that the court split that way, the same way that one would expect them to split on the underlying political issue that ostensibly they weren't even considering. So that's my big overarching concern. And another ancillary point onto all this is to pick up on what Colette was saying about, you know, the benefits to be had about open judiciary, the open process. And I was stirred to think about this just this past week when I was reading a case. And this was before I knew that David O'Brien was going to be on the call with us. It was a Massachusetts Supreme Court decision that came out in the last couple of weeks. It was a defamation case, and at issue was the applicability of the fair report privilege, which is a defense to defamation. You know, if the media or anyone else, I guess, is reporting on what's going on in a judicial proceeding or a legislative proceeding, if it's a fair and accurate report of that, it cannot be defamation. And the Supreme Court of Massachusetts cited at length something that Oliver Wendell Holmes, when he was on the Massachusetts Supreme Court, was talking about the importance of this defense because of the need for there to be an open judiciary, for the courthouse to be open for the public, not necessarily, and here's the important part, not necessarily because of the public interest in the actual subject of the proceedings, but because of the public's interest in seeing how the administration of justice works. And so, Colette, what you were saying about, really it's all pretty mundane and you know, there's just kind of a bunch of crazy, boring sidebars and things like that in the actual, judicial process, it's important. That's really what I think is the key issue here and what the most important policy consideration for open courthouses is, you know, just so that people can see how the court system works, not necessarily to see how the particular dispute is going to be resolved.
Evan, do you think, and I know you did a post on this a while ago, that this is not a jury trial, but do you think that there's an impact of these kinds of considerations on jury trials? And is it perhaps more important when there's a jury present to be more reticent to make it into a public event?
I suppose. I mean, when I think about the problem of jurors and their relation to information, I guess I'm less concerned about the amount of information that's going to be out there for the jurors to get a hold of. What I'm more concerned about is the restrictions that are placed on jurors to you know, utilize their own will to go and seek that information. And the post that you're talking about that I wrote, I came out actually on the kind of the more, perhaps it could be labeled the antiquated side of this, in saying that I really think that the jurors should be clamped down in the process of deliberation. Well, in the process of, you know, during the trial when they're getting information and deliberating, and it's absolutely not because I believe that that openness and having information available to people and to the world at large is not a good thing. It's not because I believe that that's not a good thing, because I do think that's a good thing. It's just that in order to preserve this important aspect of the jury trial system and the way it works, we need to ensure that the environment in which they're getting the information maintains its integrity. That's what underlies the principles of the rules of evidence in the first place. So I don't want to get too far afield on here, but I'm less concerned about what information is getting out there. I think that's a good thing. I'm more concerned about what the individual jurors do. And, you know, I guess in so many words, I would say, you know, jurors, let's try to toughen up a little bit and you know, stay off of Google, at least, you know, during the trial.
Or Bing.
Hey, David, where can folks find the blogging?
Did you hear Colette? You know,
no, what did she say?
She said, or Bing.
Or Bing, absolutely.
I forgot, right.
David, where can we find the blogging and tweeting of trial proceedings guide that the Citizen Media Law Project has put out? We'll make that our resource of the week for folks.
Great. It's at citmedialaw.org, and it's within our legal guide sections.
Wonderful. That is something.
So another quick point I wanted to make was that sometimes I think that another concern might be that the mere presence of having cameras in the courtroom might prove to be, number one, a physical distraction to witnesses and perhaps even to the attorneys that are trying the case. And it also might cause the witnesses to have some sort of conscious mental adaptation of how they might present their testimony in the case. And so probably more pointedly in this case is that I don't know that the judge had disclosed at the outset of when they were trying to decide the trial date that this was in fact going to be broadcast. So if you were a witness that was potentially going to prepare testimony for the case, you might be a little bit wary about actually presenting what you were going to present if you know that there's going to be cameras on you. And it might cause you to falter while you're on the stand. It might cause you to change your testimony a little bit. And that's another consideration I think that should be at least pointed out. But that, and it's a more historical one as well. And that's something that the courts have focused on as far back as 90 years ago when they were trying to consider if cameras should be allowed in the courtroom. And I think probably today it's a little bit different because the technology in terms of the camera sizes and stuff is much less obtrusive than it was. But you still have that issue of, okay, I know I'm on camera. You know, do I want to give the same testimony that I was going to give?
And David, I think that's a real point in which the Supreme Court's majority opinion directly contradicts with what Justice Breyer and company said in the dissent. I mean, the majority opinion really put a lot of weight on this notion of witnesses saying that they would, you know, perhaps not testify if it was going to be broadcast, and that really was one of the most important things underlying the irreparable harm prong of the analysis versus Justice Breyer and what he was saying. Like, there's no evidence at all that the presence of cameras are inherently inherently affect the way that witnesses will testify. And I really picked up on his use of the word inherent there, because does that mean, you know, just having a camera there, whether it's turned on or turned off, is going to affect things? That's a different question than the knowledge of the witness as to whether or not the testimony is going to be broadcast. So it's hard to think that if a witness knows his or her testimony is going to be available to thousands, hundreds of thousands, millions of people, that wouldn't affect at least their demeanor, you know, when they're there on the stand talking about things, you know, under penalty of perjury. It would be naive to think that it wouldn't affect it somewhat.
Well, I certainly know in doing our show here each week that I, you know, sort of switch into a different mode when we decide to hit record. And that is probably really apparent when some of these unedited videos get posted out to places like blip.tv that we'll all be chatting rather casually. And then we start the show and I think our demeanor does shift a bit. And I could see, you know, that there would be that kind of distinction in court too. But presumably, if you're testifying in court, you're already, you know, prepared and on your best behavior. And, you know, if you're altering your performance for the camera, then, you know, maybe there's the showboating aspect as in the OJ trial. But for witnesses, I don't know. That's a tougher one for me to think that they're really going to change a lot.
I think the average lay witness, I think experts might be different because they could be testifying all the time or, you know, they have experience. But the average person who's never testified in court before, I mean, I don't know. I've never had a trial in my career, unfortunately, but I've done a lot of depositions. And people who are getting deposed have a camera on them most of the time. And that does, you know, in preparing a witness for their deposition, you do talk about, well, what does it mean that we have a camera? You know, you actually have to dress in a suit, perhaps, things like that. But, you know, they're nervous already, regardless of what is going on. They know every word they're saying is being taken down by a court reporter. It's going into a transcript. It's going to be used for the case. So I wonder how much more it really matters that you have a camera on them in terms of their nervousness or whatever. I do agree, Denise, that there could be a showboating problem because of the broadcast, you know, because everyone, it depends what the witness's motives are, but you know, you would think that people are first on their best behavior and secondly, a little bit nervous. So,
sure. So, David, were you paying attention to this development in Boston where the gentleman was reporting on what he thought was police brutality, or not reporting necessarily, flicked on the video recorder on his phone? And the officers took umbrage of that and accused him of illegal electronic surveillance, a la wiretapping. What's your take and the Citizen Media Law Project's take on this?
Well, actually, I think we're working on preparing a post on that exact incident probably later this week, as far as I know. So here in Boston, we've had sort of a troubled time lately in terms of police issues. Most people will probably recall the incident that occurred in Cambridge where the Harvard professor, who happened to be a black Harvard professor, was arrested outside of his home for being drunk and disorderly and resisting arrest. And it caused, of course, the national controversy. And it also caused President Obama, who had personally known this person, to come out and make a statement. So since then, I think, or at least for that short period thereafter that event, some of the relationships with the Boston police and the Cambridge police have been somewhat strained. And interesting, what happened in this case, as far as I know, is that this individual was walking down the street and he saw somebody getting arrested. And it appeared that the police officer was being a little rough with the person he was arresting. And so he takes out his camera and the police officer turns to him and says, "Does that camera have a record function on it?" And of course, the person with the camera says yes. And the next thing he knows, he finds himself in handcuffs for illegal electronic surveillance. And the law as it stands here in Massachusetts is that you need to have both people consent to any time that you're having a recording going on. So it, by way of basically arresting this person, the police officer was saying, "I do not consent to you recording me." And it's pretty troubling that this can go on, because I think it really sort of eschews a public check on the police that would otherwise be in place, whereby, you know, if you see something going on, sort of the classic Rodney King example of videotaping some sort of police brutality, you can record it and show it to the world. You can take your pitchfork and head over to Twitter and post it all around and let everybody know that this is what's going on. Using this law in this particular way is pretty troubling that the police are doing that. And, you know, it's too bad that it went this way.
Wow. Let me back up for a second and explore what you said about needing to get consent before you record someone. How does that play out with all the recording devices in people's hands and all, you know, people going around recording sporting events or just public life? You know, how is that playing out in Boston? Is it a matter of it's not admissible in court unless consent is obtained, or is there an illegality if you're not going out and getting consent?
That's another good question, and it's not something that I'm terribly familiar with, to be honest. But for the most part, if you're walking around in one of our lovely parks here in downtown Boston, you're snapping pictures, you're not going to have any problems because you're you're just taking pictures. But once you get into the, especially the audio recording aspect of it, that's usually where the electronic surveillance laws kick in. And in those cases, you know, both people have to be aware that there's a recording going on, and they also have to basically consent to being recorded. Otherwise, you fall under this illegal surveillance law.
Is there no exception for like newsworthy data or information collection? Or I don't know. I mean, I think a variety of publicity laws often have a exception for a newsworthy photograph that's taken and put on the cover of a magazine or newspaper at the time. So,
right, and privacy laws have an exception for things that go on in public where there's no reasonable expectation of privacy.
Huh. Right, right. And those are the classic examples, I think, that will still apply here in these cases. It's mostly, as far as I know, is mostly about the audio recording aspect of it. So when you have a camera phone out like that, presumably if you're shooting video, you're recording both the audio and the video.
Right. Mm. Interesting.
Evan, any thoughts?
Well, I think it's troubling, and I hope that the reports that you know we've been reading about it, and I guess David, you would know better than anyone. You've been following it more closely, but I hope that at least the report I read on Boston.com is an exaggeration of some of this stuff, because it's very troubling if the police are doing that. They're choose your metaphor here. They're putting a square peg in a round hole, or shoehorning something in, applying this statute in a way that's clearly not intended. So. I'm pretty slow to be one of those people who say that there needs to be legislative action on this. But in this situation, if that's what the police are doing, I do think that the General Assembly, is that what you call it in Massachusetts, needs to step in and enact some kind of exception for this that you're talking about, Colette, or do something here. Make it clear, somehow exclude law enforcement activities from this, because it's troubling to me.
Right, and the other thing is that this wasn't just an isolated incident either. If you look at the Boston.com article, I think they pointed to two, maybe one or two other circumstances where you had local students, like Boston University students, who had similar experiences with the police where they had some sort of recording device. And as soon as they took it out, the police arrested them on the spot. And I know that the local ACLU has been involved in helping people getting those charges dismissed. But, it's pretty troubling that this seems to be going on.
Yeah, good for them, because this goes to that principle that I was talking about earlier when we were talking about the Prop 8 broadcast issue. It's not so much the importance of what is really being broadcast here, what's being put out there. It's just that there's something important about keeping that ability to see how justice and the law is being administered, so that those with authority to administer the law, whether it be law enforcement or the courts, are accountable to the public that they serve. So we could quote Oliver Wendell Holmes again on this, and it would be binding authority on the courts of Massachusetts. So it's there's no way to overstate the policy implication of this. I hate to use the term because it's such a cliche, but of transparency here.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we've had a couple of stories where transparency and sharing of information have been front and center. Evan, you sent in a link about France wanting to make sure that some information can only be shared for so long and then shared no longer. Do you want to bring us up to speed on France's right to forget law?
Sure. I thought this was pretty amusing and certainly raises some interesting things to talk about. There's a report. I don't know if it's – I don't get the impression that it is actually legislation that's been – introduced yet, but there's some talk coming from France about, as if they're pondering what people are calling a right to forget law. And this really is, I'll just go ahead and characterize it as a paternalistic kind of effort on the part of the French government to protect, people who may not have the full amount of discretion when posting information about themselves online. Or I guess it could relate to information that other people post as well. But in essence, what the law would do is, I gather from what the reports we read on, is it would require that personal information about somebody found online be deleted after a certain period of time, or perhaps at that person's request. And the goal of here, obviously, is reputation management, making sure that people aren't getting in too much trouble for things that are out there about them. And you know, as I said, it's a very paternalistic kind of effort, because it's the government making sure that people's reputations are protected. It's an interesting notion. I see, obviously, that there are some technical obstacles that would be overcome here. I mean, certainly a law that applies in France would apply, you know, just to the up to the borders of France. So, you know, what right would a French court, for example, have to order information be deleted off of a server that's in the U.S.? But it's clearly an interesting little thing here, and I put up a tweet about it, you know, my take on it. It reminds me a little bit, if there were a law like this enacted, it reminds me of the notion of the memory hole that you see in George Orwell's 1984, which was the Ministry of Information, the workers there. If there was a piece of information that was not fit to be part of the collection of information describing how the way the world is, it was put into the memory hole, which, you know, led directly to a big incinerator where information was done away with forever, never to rear its head again in the public consciousness. So it reminds me a little bit of that in an amusing way, of course, but in as much as it's an attempt by the government to essentially ensure that history can be rewritten in a way that the participants in that history deem fit some point later in time, which is the most intriguing aspect of it to me.
Yeah, what strikes me as a little funny about it is that, as I read it, what they're pondering applies to public information, not private, personal, confidential medical records, data that's collected about you because of your use of a certain service under the terms of service of that service, but it's stuff that's, you know, blog posts and news stories and that kind of thing. Is that right?
Yeah, I guess so. And again, I don't think that it's actually legislation that's been drafted, so it's still pretty nebulous and amorphous. And, you know, we may never hear about it again. Maybe it will, you know, get wadded up and shoved down the memory hole, the whole notion of this proposed legislation. But yeah, I think that it would be geared toward, you know, not to raise too many cliches in one conversation here or cliche notions, but it would be geared toward, you know, the infamous pictures of yourself from college doing a keg stand, you know, or being passed out drunk. You know, it would address that situation where you would have the right after a certain period of time or you know, on demand or whatever to have that information taken out of public consciousness.
Got it. So, Colette, you have considered some privacy issues in your practice. Do you have any thoughts on this and whether it's a good idea or just impractical?
I think it's, I can't imagine how they can effectively do what they're talking about wanting to do. Not just, I mean, if they pass a law, that's great, but the practical implication and how you would deal with the extraterritorial problems that they're going to run into that Evan mentioned. I do think about, though, this reputation issue, which I find fascinating, mm-hmm. because we have a generation or several generations of people who were both pre-internet and pre-digital, and now new younger generations who are digital natives and have been in this environment their whole, you know, public existence. And, you know, there's this is the problem of the college newspaper from the 1960s that has pictures of somebody doing things that, you know, they thought were in their past. And now they're a a business executive somewhere, and this college newspaper has been digitized, and these photos are now surfacing and calls into question this person's, last 20 years of their career. Are they really who they are? You know, can we really trust somebody like this? Or there was a case, I believe, some time ago at Cornell where the college newspaper was put online, and it included in the newspaper, you know, things that were new police arrests, and somebody who had been arrested for theft back when they were in college, and you know, this thing was in an archive in the university in print, but hadn't been digitized, and now that it's digitized, anytime you search for that person's name, that one incident of theft when they were quite young and may not have been, may have learned their lesson, now comes back to rear its head. And this problem is going to be with us for some time. But what I think will happen over time is the norms will shift, and not every, you know, people will start to understand context better. You know, the context of when that happened, how old you were, what you were doing. I think people will look with some skepticism at what they find online about somebody until they can, you know, confirm it in other ways or understand its context. But right now we're sort of beginners, and we don't, you know, a lot of people don't know how this stuff will be perceived. And especially if you're trying to find a job and a background check comes back and it's got 500 hits, some of which are these incidents that you don't think really reflect your character, and you're being dealing with that. That's the issue, I think.
Well, I think this goes right to what Marshall Kilpatrick wrote about this last week, when Mark Zuckerberg of Facebook got on the stage with Mike Arrington at their Crunchy Awards ceremony, and started talking about the shift in attitudes about privacy that he perceives among the users of Facebook, and basically said that, you know, we view it as our role to be constantly innovating and updating what our system is to reflect what the current social norms are. And according to him, the social norms are now, contrary to when he started Facebook, over the last 5 or 6 years, they have shifted to people being much more open about sharing their materials and wanting the ability to do that. And maybe that's true, but you know, if you couple that with what Facebook did recently on its privacy controls, switching the defaults to a much more public kind of atmosphere without really telegraphing what that meant or explaining to people that there was this shift going on from, you know, a private kind of universe to a more public one by default. Marshall Kilpatrick certainly was concerned about it. I'm a bit concerned about it, too. How about you, Evan? What are your thoughts?
I think Marshall's analysis is really pretty insightful on this situation. You know, soon after, like maybe the day or so after Zuckerberg and the Zuckerberg Arrington interview, you know, Marshall posted on Read Write Web a pretty good contraposition, if you will, saying, you know, it's just really it's too bad that Facebook's taking this position, retracting essentially their position that privacy, what Zuckerberg had said a couple of years ago, that privacy is the vector around which Facebook is built, and you know, this granular control is one of the things that makes Facebook different. And then on January 11th on Read Write Web, the post that Marshall Kilpatrick followed up with is called "Why Facebook is Wrong, Privacy is Still Important." This was one of the most interesting things I've read about this issue in a long time. The thesis really of what he's talking about in this is based on some work done by Chris Peterson at Massachusetts is everywhere in this conversation. Mm-hmm. University of Massachusetts Amherst, who's wrote a thesis about that's really interesting about this, and I mean, I know that I'm radically simplifying it, probably oversimplifying it here, but essentially is the privacy concerns that people have really are not based on secrecy, but they're based on what you alluded to, Colette, this notion of context. And we expect a certain integrity of context when we're putting information out there on the web. And the example that's in this post, and I don't know if it belongs to Peterson or if it belongs to Marshall Kirkpatrick, but you know, you don't drink in church and you don't pray at the bar. So, you know, that's the integrity of context that's so important here. And what Facebook
well,
has
unless
done,
you're Irish, and then you might do both.
Right, right.
You know.
Hey, sorry. Right.
And so by opening Facebook up, you know, to oversimplify it here, Facebook has disrupted this ecosystem in which the integrity of context had become so ingrained, you know, the ability to control your privacy settings so that only certain information would go to certain people. It's disrupted that, and it essentially has violated the equilibrium that was there so far, and perhaps has. And I think now I'm talking more of myself, less than what Kirkpatrick and Peterson were saying, but it's really now kind of been a step back. By doing that, because this whole kind of neat way that Facebook operated before, with this understanding that if you put certain information out there, it will be available only to certain people, served everybody well, and it was a kind of a step beyond this very conservative view that a lot of people take, especially when drafting, you know, social media policies or something like that. Everything that you put on the web is out there forever and, you know, you're going to have to live with it. Maybe that's not necessarily true, was kind of like the old view pre-mid-December when Facebook changed this. But now it's more likely true that the stuff that you put out there is there forever, and there's not this expectation of an integrity of context, which I think is a very elegant concept to describe this.
Hey, Colette, I know you need to run fairly quickly here. Do you want to give us your 2 cents on this before you go?
Sure, yeah. I think, you know, I'm with the Facebook stuff, I think we just have to remember they are a business. They have business goals and purposes in mind. And what Mark Zuckerberg says today, really, and said on that stage with the Michael Arrington, really contradicts things that he said, you know, 18 months ago, where he said about these privacy issues, oh, well, we're really kind of pushing the envelope, and we are, you know, understand that we're an innovator in this space, and we're going to do things that push the envelope on these issues. And now, 18 months later, he says, my company is just reflecting back what the social norms are. So I think we need to hold Facebook under scrutiny for, you know, both what their business purposes are, and make sure that they know that people are paying attention to these problems. And, you know, 18 months or 5 years is not enough to unseat centuries of privacy considerations in law and, you know, views and social norms. And so things do move fast in the web, but I'm very skeptical when Facebook and its leaders make these pronouncements, because they do have a huge impact. And people hear that and think, oh, okay, I guess privacy is over. And it really isn't. They're one player. They're a strong player. But we need to hold them accountable to the things that they've said in the past and remember their business goals here.
It would be nice if they weren't so diametrical about it, or so, you know, black and white, if Mark Zuckerberg wasn't so like, you know, privacy is over. And I don't think he actually said that privacy is over, privacy is dead, or anything like the headlines have attributed to him. But certainly that's the gist of what he said. And I think that if we're going to be intelligent about this discussion, we've got to realize that it's probably a combination of factors here. Both Facebook retracting a little bit from its very it's nominally pro-privacy position of 2 years ago, 18 months ago, a retraction of that, and then it's kind of an advancement, if you will, not necessarily in a positive way, but a certain progression of norms on privacy. It's probably a combination of both of those things to put us in the current state of affairs. And Colette, what you were talking about, you know, some skepticism that you raised about people's norms changing so fast, I'm kind of with you there as well. But I'm also, as I have announced, in my Twitter stream earlier this week, I've finally gotten around to reading Ray Kurzweil's "The Singularity Is Near." So I am ever more increasingly perceptive of the rate at which things are changing, both in terms of technological advances. I think that concomitantly, there along with, norms will probably start changing exponentially quickly as well. So that was, I'm glad that you brought that up, because it gave me an opportunity to put a little singularity spin on things here.
Absolutely. Wonderful. And we're not going to be done with that, as you'll see in a minute when we get to our Audible pick. But Colette, I want to let you go. And
thank you.
Note that the chat room is thrilled to see that although you're working at Microsoft, you have not grown horns, and we're thrilled to see it too.
Oh, yeah. There's no plug in the back of my head. I was worried about that. The orientation was very good, and I'm just learning my way around right now. But it's been a wonderful place to start work at, and I'm excited to be here, but hopefully I won't be too constrained in what I can say from time to time.
Are you still going to keep your vogelaw.com site?
Yeah, it's total. I mean, it still is as it always was. I need to update it, and I'll keep that, and it'll probably turn into more of a personal page. And I do intend to start a blog there and kind of bring my online presence into that site over time.
So. And we can still find you at Vogelaw on Twitter, correct?
Yes. That'll be around. Good.
And thanks. We'll find you again next week, I hope, back on the show.
Sounds great. Absolutely. Looking forward to it. Have a good week, everyone.
All right, see you later.
All right. So, Evan, I was looking for was it The Singularity Is Near or The Age of Spiritual Machines that you're reading?
I'm reading The Singularity is Near. But, with titles like that, they're all compelling. What is it? The Age of Intelligent Machines that he wrote back in the early 90s. And then I think in 98 was The Age of Spiritual Machines. Just wonderful, wonderful
yes.
concepts. Really neat.
Absolutely.
I can't believe it's taken me 5 years. I mean, it's a little bit ironic or paradoxical or just, it's just weird. I've had The Singularity is Near sitting on my shelf for 5 years. So, I mean, good grief. The singularity is so much closer, now than what it was when I got the book. It's even more than 5 years, closer, I guess, since there's this advancement in the extent of technological progress. So.
But yes, and as you pointed out when you tweeted, I think you said the book had been sitting on your shelf for 5 years or something without having been read. And I'm afraid my Kurzweil books meet that fate too. They start them out with great ambitions of finishing the whole thing and then peter out somewhere halfway through. But
they are very, very dense. I don't think I've, it's still accessible too, because, it's so interesting. And any, person of reasonable intelligence can get something out of it. If I'm getting something out of it, anybody could. But I haven't read anything quite that, where every sentence says something meaningful. It's been a long time since I've read a book quite like that. So I'm really excited to be reading it.
Yes, and in case I haven't telegraphed this clearly enough yet, let me come out and say that I'm segueing here into our Audible ad and thanking audible.com for their support of TWIL and the TWIT Network. And there are a couple of interesting Kurzweil offerings on Audible. First off, The Age of Spiritual Machines is there in abridged form. And also, I'm going to download when we get off the show here today. You know how C-SPAN has their, I think it's called Book Talk or Book Chat or whatever their literary show is. There's a almost 3-hour interview with Kurzweil called In Depth with Ray Kurzweil from C-SPAN on that show, where I actually started listening to it, and they go way, way back to, I think he made an appearance on the Steve Allen show, and he was demonstrating one of his musical products and endeavors, and his career and life have been so interesting. And then he, of course, is responsible for, I don't know if you guys were old enough to be trying out all the lawyer dictation stuff in the early 90s when it first came out, but Dragon Dictate and all that stuff that was the first forays into voice recognition. We have Ray to thank for that too. So go and check out the in-depth radio TV program from C-SPAN and also The Age of Spiritual Machines at audiblepodcast.com/twill. And when you do, you can download either of them for free, and you'll be enrolled in the Audible Listener Gold program, which is the program that I have with Audible, and it allows you to have a credit for a free download each month. So save the other one, and you can save them. They accrue. They don't expire like cell phone minutes with some carriers. Your unused credits do accrue, so you can save them up. And when you're taking a long trip on an airplane or car, this is a great way to actually get through some fairly dense material. We had, as a recommendation once, Neal Stephenson's Anathem, and I don't think I ever would have read that book cover to cover, but listening to it on Audible was a privilege. So these, I think, are going to be similar kinds of fare, and I support. You can also follow Audible on Twitter at twitter.com/audible_com. So let's see, we've talked about privacy and transparency. One thing I thought it would be interesting to kind of circle back and consider once again about this Prop 8 case, just sort of a footnote to our prior discussion there, is for all their not wanting to make the trial proceedings themselves public, the proponents of Prop 8 have been very public on their protectmarriage.com site in their blog on putting out their own updates from the trial, their own take on the trial. And one blog post I put in our show notes because I thought it was pretty interesting was from yesterday. Actually, I think it says it's dated January 15th, which is today, so it must have gone up after midnight. But it's from the general counsel of protectmarriage.com, Andy Pugno, if I'm saying that right. And Andy here is giving his really detailed analysis and insights about why he thought the witnesses were off base in trial that day. And when I read this, I was thinking to myself, okay, so I have a good insight into how his side of the case is going to go after these witnesses on closing argument or in their briefing. It really seemed to be a view into the lawyer's brain about, you know, how they were going to address what had happened in court today. And where I come from, I would consider that attorney work product. And I was kind of surprised to see it out there on the web. Did you guys take a look at this? And I think it's interesting, just in, you know, another twist on digital media and the judicial process, that there is this ability to look inside lawyers' brains if they're willing to do it. But I also, you know, kind of am concerned about the ethical ramifications of that. David, did you take a look?
I did, and I thought that this was pretty interesting because just from a strategic standpoint, I don't know why you would want to put some of those thoughts out there, because then you might give the other side, of course, ways to attack your positions. And definitely the ethical implications are concern me too, because this is something that could potentially qualify as the attorney's work product. And in those circumstances, you can't release that type of information without your client's consent. So, you know, it's a little concerning that this is out there like that and it's in such detail. But, you know, assuming that he has all the necessary permissions that he has, he's, you know, allowed to do that. But I guess I just don't understand why you would want to give that insight right into your brain.
Yeah, it was weird to me. It almost, when I read this, it was like, okay, this guy doesn't realize. I think he does. He's a politician, and, you know, public life can be no real mystery to him. But reading this, it's almost like he thinks it's going out to some private list, or, you know, that only the supporters of Protect Marriage will be reading this material. And, you know, that's not the case. It's out on the public web. What does litigator Evan think of all this?
Well, clearly this is a very polarizing issue, you know, this question over Proposition 8. And there's no doubt that Mr. Pugno, I guess, who's writing this, is exhibiting a great amount of bravado by doing it. And I suppose that in an abstract sense, or generally speaking, about, you know, the question of whether or not a trial attorney should do this, I suppose it's not implausible to think that it could be done to one's advantage. We're getting an insight into their thinking here. Perhaps it opens them up for, you know, it shows, you know, the structure of their thinking, which could then necessarily have the opponent be able to identify where the weaknesses are in those structures. That's one side of it. But then there's the flip side of it, in as much as it could reinforce the position and solidify it and kind of meld it all together into a cohesive whole here. So it's definitely an important, because it has the effect because it has the potential to be so effective, I guess, the potential to have such an effect, to disclose so much about one's thinking, litigators should consider very carefully, you know, how they're actually going to do it here. But circling back to what I said at the very first, you know, this is a very polarizing issue, and the parties on both sides are very entrenched in their positions. You know, they're worlds apart in terms of how they view fundamental relations among people, between people in the world. So it could be that what we're seeing here is an effect of that. A certain sense of impunity to attack right or wrong, whether that impunity is well-founded or not, it's a certain sense of impunity or infallibility or, you know, just being beyond reproach, thinking, you know, we're on the side of good and right and justice here. So no matter what we say, it's not going to have a negative impact. The fundamental moral issues are more important. That could be what, you know, is informing this as well here. So I'm glad you brought it up.
Yeah. Well, for anybody who's interesting, I'm sorry, David, I'll come back to that in a sec. For anybody who's interested, excuse me, somehow I got on the email list for Protect Marriage. Not because I'm a supporter of their cause, which in fact I'm not, but I think back when the initiative was being lobbied for, I might have signed up for the email list just to keep track of the discussion. So now I'm getting their updates on their site and et cetera. And one of the things they've alerted me to is that there is a bloggers-only update call today at 5:30 Pacific time. So if anyone is interested in a blogger and wants to get more information direct from the horse's mouth on these folks' side of the case, you can call in at 916-834-9969 today, Friday the 15th, and chat with them about things. So another instance of transparency around trials. David, what were you going to say?
Well, I was just thinking, you know, in terms of the transparency issues, maybe this is important because that some of these posts do go out, because maybe it sort of underscores the fact that trials don't always operate in the same way that the public might perceive them to operate. And especially in the case of witnesses that are going to be called and after the discovery process, usually the attorneys have a pretty good idea of what evidence is going to be presented at a trial. And especially since this is such a polarizing issue and everybody seems to have an opinion on it, more so probably than ever, the attorneys in this case are pretty aware of what's going to make its way into the trial in terms of trial testimony.
Right. Absolutely. Okay. So, let's talk some more about trials and the web. There was a blog post I put in our links here that was positing that perhaps the legal system is changing in the age of the web, and that lawsuits might be reduced or discouraged because blogging is better than going to court. And this was on Kimberly Hauser's blog. She was writing about how blogging is a faster way to reach your target audience. It's much cheaper than going to court. A blog with a wide readership has enormous potential to affect positive corporate and societal change. And she raised examples like what Jeff Jarvis did in connection with Dell a couple of years ago. What do you guys think of this? Is the social web having an impact on the actual dockets in our judicial system? Evan?
Who knows? That would be an interesting area of empirical inquiry to see if the nature of claims has changed, or the quantity of you know, consumer type complaints has changed in the last 5-7 years. No doubt smart companies like, well, I guess we'll call Dell a smart company because they did respond to Jeff Jarvis's grumblings back in 2005, you know, in the notion of Dell hell and all of that stuff. Smart companies, no doubt, are going to be responsive to public opinion, public sentiment, consumer sentiment like this, and will respond accordingly. So where I think that leads us in the real inquiry here as to the efficacy of this is, from the consumer standpoint, whether to go to court or whether to just blog about it is going to be informed by what it is that you're looking for. If you're just looking for injunctive relief, you know, for the company to stop doing what it's doing, then blogging's probably going to be pretty good. If you have a real colorable claim for money damages, I doubt most companies are going to pay you a whole bunch just in response to a blog post. You may get a gift certificate or a coupon or some kind of voucher. But if you really have some severe damage that you're looking to be remunerated for, then I don't think that this notion has much validity. But it certainly does if you're looking for the kind of change that would come about in the nature of injunctive relief.
So, Mr. O'Brien, and I apologize for the earlier Irish crack. I myself am Irish, or I would never have made such a crack. What do you think? Does citizen media perhaps start to replace the judicial process on some level by shining a light on problems that otherwise would get aired in court?
Well, I think potentially it will at some point, or maybe it will get close to that at some point. I don't think that we're there yet. And you do see some great examples. I do recall one where actually Leo Laporte, probably a year or two ago, had some problem and either tweeted about it or posted about it or brought it up on Twit. And within like 24 hours, he had a response from the manufacturer, whatever the problem was. And, you know, they changed their policies or they fixed something. And that's an interesting example, along with, I'm sure there's countless others, of where people are able to raise the noise level enough to actually make change. But the problem is there's so much noise out there right now, and we're sort of in this more mature stage of social media and Web 2.0 that everybody seems to have a blog and everybody has a Twitter account. So when people are tweeting or blogging about things, it becomes difficult to get around all the other noise that is out there. And the other thing is that sometimes there was that one case that came out where that unfortunate tenant had tweeted about a mold problem or some sort of problem in her apartment building. She found herself at the other end of a lawsuit, and the management company had sued her for defamation, or what amounted to defamation in their eyes, in terms of the tweet saying that, well, I guess this company doesn't care about my mold problem or whatever was going wrong with her apartment. So, mm-hmm. It's sort of interesting to see the interplay with how things work, but definitely now that the web is so much more open and there's so many more channels that you can communicate through, I think it's changing a little bit, and there are probably more effective ways to effectuate change rather than filing a lawsuit, which is immensely expensive. But of course, it costs nothing to go and set up a Twitter stream or to set up a blog and get your thoughts out there to the world.
And I think if you're going to take that route, using social media to affect change in your relation with a company, that there are certain obvious ways that you can be smart about it and not detrimental to the idea you're trying to get across. I know I've had a few conversations with Rick Clow about this. You know, he was more involved with this kind of stuff when he was back at FeedBurner, when FeedBurner was still here in Chicago. And, you know, FeedBurner is one of those companies that monitored the chat or the forum boards and monitored blog comments across the web and everything, and was very responsive. I mean, I believe that they had a policy, or if it wasn't a policy, it might as well have been one, because this is how they acted, of responding to just about everything that was said about FeedBurner in any kind of open medium. And, clearly you can be much more effective and get the company's attention in a good way if you're, grown up about it and mature about it. Don't use too many four-letter words, when complaining about a company, because you got to realize that these are people just like you and me who are monitoring this stuff and who are responsive to it. So it's much more likely to effectuate change and to have this be an effective way of relating with the company if you're going to be mature in your approach about it.
Also interesting is that if you have a client that comes to you and they have some sort of problem with the company, usually the first course of advice that people give is, okay, let's not file a lawsuit yet. Let's get in touch with the company and try to resolve this without having to go to litigation. And so sort of in that sense, I guess the social media channels might offer just a different way of going about it, but making it more public. Whereas if you were going to privately communicate with a company, as an attorney representing a client saying, my client has this problem, the whole conversation changes at that point and other people become more aware of it. And so I guess that also makes it a little bit more effective on social media, provided that you can get that attention that you need.
Right. And everybody knows that people have, I don't want to generalize too much, but, it's certainly natural to think that a lot of people are motivated by a vindictive sense or revenge when they go online and want to talk bad about a company. And that's another thing that can be ineffective. And it's something that is a different nature and character than what you're talking about, David, of this direct communication, because you're less motivated by vindictiveness in those kind of direct communications.
So another thing that happened just this last week was Google's coming out about they're being hacked and people getting access to the Gmail accounts of Chinese dissidents. I don't really have a legal spin on this other than we have talked on the show before about the ability of employers or the government to access one's mail accounts that are either within an employment context on the employer's servers or on a separate third-party server like Google. And one of the things we mentioned is that Gmail and other services like it are a good way to protect your private information from being intruded on because of the encryption that's available there. One thing that Google did in connection with this China episode, which has been so interesting to watch unfold, is it changed the default. So you used to be able to select that your Gmail would be on HTTPS. Now it's going to be there by default. I don't know if they've flipped that switch for everyone. So I wanted to make our tip of the week something from the Gmail blog that mentioned that you can go into your settings on Gmail and go ahead and flip that switch for yourself already if you have not done so, to make all your Gmail encrypted by choice, and soon it will be by default. David, did you follow the Gmail China episode, and do you have any thoughts on that you want to share?
A little bit. I haven't dug too deep into the story yet, but certainly whenever you're using a third-party web service like Gmail for email accounts, you have to be concerned about how they're handling your data when they're storing it, and what are they going to do for you in the event, in the worst-case scenario, if their servers get hacked and somebody gets access to the mail that you have stored onto there. And, that's also been one of the most important things that people have been concerned about in terms of moving over to cloud computing. In terms of what happened in this particular case, I guess I'm just not familiar enough with the details. So was there anything else that seemed pertinent in it?
No, other than just to mention about the tip of turning on the encryption. The chat room is chiming in that, oh, but you'll be slower. I did this, actually I did it some time ago and really haven't noticed any perceptible change. So, you know, I think it's definitely worth doing. Evan, any thoughts?
Not necessarily on the security side of things. I mean, we want to just be smart users in any instance that we can. And so that's, you know, why the tip is certainly apropos to all of this. You know, my thoughts about the whole Google China situation is, you know, on a larger free speech, global policy side of things. I wrote a blog post on my personal blog. It didn't fit onto internet cases, you know, a little bit too off topic here, but with a little bit of skepticism as to Google's motives for pulling out of China here, and essentially just to sum it up without going to a whole lot of detail here, this is a much subtler picture than free speech and anti-censorship and all of that stuff. There, I think it's interesting to see the enormously complicated system of multiple business factors going into this, as well as the free speech, human rights side of things. So that's, you know, like you were, started this point up saying it's a bit challenging to find a legal bent to take on this whole mm-hmm. issue. That's where I can kind of see it connected to a legal policy, very high scale, abstract, global kind of policy issue.
Right. Now, I of course saw, you know, when all of this came out, but I haven't followed it very closely thereafter. I know that right in the aftermath of their post, you were all of a sudden able to see what had been previously censored, things like images of Tiananmen Square on China on Google.cn. Have they been blocked now?
I don't know the status of that. I know that it's been interesting to see how China itself has reacted to the announcement of the prospective pullout here. And, we got to remind ourselves again, you know, Google has not agreed to withdraw its operations from China. It's just saying that it's not going to censor the results anymore. And, right. And my initial thought was, well, this is an effort on Google's part to gain some kind of leverage with the Chinese government. And I haven't been corrected directly, you know, by any direct communications on that. But several sources that I've read, including, you know, a post that Sarah Lacey put up on TechCrunch, say, well, this is just really not how you do business with the Chinese government. This is kind of irreversible, bridge burning, scorched earth kind of approach that Google's taking here. There's probably little to be salvaged with their relationship with the Chinese government. So, you know, who knows why, if that's true, you know, why would they have much of an incentive to start blocking images of Tiananmen Square again if this is kind of an irreversible course that Google has taken on this?
I would have loved to have been a fly on the wall during the time that decision was made at Google.
Uh-huh. Yeah, that would be interesting. And toward the end of the infamous post, you know, they wanted to stress that it was a decision made by the Google executives over here. It was without the participation or without the knowledge of the folks on the ground in China. And I remember, you know, highlighting that in my mind when I read that, kind of wondering why. And I don't know if you guys have any thoughts as to why it would be just the decision to be made over here and not involving China, if it's so important to, you know, the future of those people on the ground working in China.
Yeah, no, I don't have any thoughts on that. That post was interesting in so many ways. First of all, the author of it was David Drummond, their chief legal officer, another sort of tenuous legal tie. Secondly, it never directly accused the government of China of perpetrating the attack. It just sort of left that as the conclusion that one might logically draw. Right. And certainly that seems to be the conclusion that Google has drawn, because presumably it's the government of China that has imposed all of the censorship requirements, and Google has now decided to stop adhering to those requirements. So,
right, because when talking about the security breaches, the post, you know, was very clear that, you know, they're working with, you know, U.S. authorities to try to figure out, you know, what's gone wrong here and what's the connection with these 20 or so other other companies who have been, you know, the subject of these malicious attacks as well. They're conspicuous by its absence is a mention of any cooperation by the Chinese government, which is, you know, leaves kind of one of those wide spaces in between the lines where we're to read that it was the Chinese government's involvement, which I think is a really interesting way of presenting it.
Yeah. AJ in the chat room is pointing out that Google might have gone to that step of being clear that no one in China was involved to prevent reprisals against those people in China, which is probably very true.
Yeah. Well, you know, I mean, what can you expect to do? I mean, the Chinese government's not all that forgiving. You know, who are they going to really put much credence in a statement like that? That's one of the points I mentioned in my post was, and I wrote it, you know, the following morning. I would have written it on February 13th because the announcement came out, you know, within hours of the Haiti earthquake. So I am associating those events. I wrote it on the morning of the 13th. So, you know, how would you feel to be an employee in the Shanghai office of Google that morning, or, you know, worse yet, you know, an executive? You know, you probably had better slept with one eye open last night. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I don't envy those folks over there in China, regardless of whether they were involved in the decision or not.
Well, since we've gotten onto global topics here, and since we've been talking a lot about transparency in this show, let's talk about ACTA. Anti-counterfeiting trade agreement. David, the Citizen Media Law Project is all for figuring out what this thing has to say and not a big fan of the secrecy. You want to give us your 2 cents on what's going on here?
Well, this has just been one of those classic subjects that has been debated over, I guess, the last 2 years now, since at least 2008 when these discussions started. And this is another one of these global trade agreements, and I think the premise at first was mostly about physical goods and coming up with new ways to enforce intellectual property rights in other countries. And that's been one of the classic problems with the international agreements, is that even though that we have these methods of, say, a U.S. company going into another country and being able to enforce its intellectual property rights there, the local governments are not necessarily as good at enforcing those judgments when they come out in those courts of law. And so this process has been going on for some time, and it's been entirely veiled in secrecy. And I think the little that we do know about it, it all comes from a leaked document which has shown up on WikiLeaks. And it raises a bunch of concerning issues in it. And it appears that it's not focused so much on physical goods. Now it appears to be going into intangible goods. So we're talking about digital intellectual property rights. And more importantly, the potential impact seems to also include ISPs. And ISPs are now going to be, or at least under this one draft that we saw in WikiLeaks, they ISPs might be compelled by law to have some sort of role in the enforcement of intellectual property rights. And that might mean some sort of three strikes policy, where if you have a repeat infringer, their internet access is entirely cut off. It might mean more things like we've seen from Comcast in terms of the traffic throttling. And definitely there's some concerns over the deep packet inspections that might be going on as well. So you have some privacy concerns that sort of get folded into all of this. And you know, the other big thing too is that you worry about some of these agreements when you have more agreements that come out. So let's assume that ACTA comes out, it gets passed, it's got all this awful stuff in it. When further agreements come out, if someone wants to do another international agreement or an international trade agreement, sometimes you have conditions in those trade agreements which require you to be members of other trade agreements. So you might sort of leverage or force people to sign on to the ACTA agreement then. And the whole fact that this has gone on in secrecy and that the entertainment industry has clearly had some sort of role in it, and that the not only that, they're also very supportive of it too, which raises a lot of eyebrows to begin with. It also appears that a lot of senators aren't really aware of what's going on. There's been numerous FOIA requests in order to get some of the information released to the public, and as far as I know, all of which were denied by the Obama administration. So a lot of concerns here. Another great example of why transparency is important. And, you know, the biggest concern of all is the fact that the public seems to be cut out of this entire process. And we don't know what's going to be included in it. And you don't want people to, especially the recording industry or any of the entertainment industry, to sort of take the reins in their own hands and, you know, come up with some policies that end up being enforced in the U.S. that, you know, otherwise might not have passed through in the same way, you know, through the U.S. legislature.
Yeah, it seems like some of the legislators are starting to grumble about all the secrecy and demand that the public be let into what's going on here. But I don't know that grumbling is going to make any difference. Senator Wyden came out with something recently. Evan, do you have any thoughts on operating behind closed doors in forming multinational trade agreements, or this one in particular?
Just to pick up on what you were saying there, you know, my most recent education on the status of ACTA was from, you know, TechDirt, Mike Masnick's post from Tuesday, the January 12th. And you know, he was talking about the, you know, the panelist at that event that Google had on Monday in connection with, you know, World Fair Use Day or something like
that. In D.C.
Yes. And, you know, his observation there was that, yes, there are starting to be some grumblings from politicians about that, but they're really only grumbling about the fact of non-transparency or the fact that it's secret, and there's been little grumbling about the actual merits or the substance of what the treaty is supposed to say. And I suppose that that's a bit of a chicken and the egg problem. Since it is secret, we you know, aren't, you know, really supposed to know what the substance is or should be, or if, you know, if a legislator does know, you know, what the substance of it is, he or she would be bound by a certain obligation to not disclose that. So the bottom line on this, or, you know, one way to conclude this point is to say that even though there is some grumbling by legislators, members of the Senate about this, it really is of little import or doesn't have the potential to be of much consequence if they're really not going after the problematic substance of it, and instead just focusing on the question of transparency. Yes, it's a shame that it's an opaque process. What are we going to do about it? Well, I guess we can't really do all that much, seems to be the hamstrung position that we find ourselves in on this, which is of course unfortunate.
Yep. One to keep an eye on and unpack as more information comes available. Watch WikiLeaks, you know, I guess.
One other thing is the fact that I believe during TRIPS and WIPO, when those two international agreements were being negotiated, that was an open process and people were aware of what the discussions were and what the relevant points were. We just don't have that in this case. And, you know, I think that some of the interested groups have sort of intimated that the reason is they don't want to distract from the negotiations, but that's definitely at our expense.
Yeah, and WIPO was, I mean, am I correct in my understanding here? The DMCA was passed in the U.S. as part of a requirement of WIPO. Is that right, David?
Or definitely portions of it were, I think, incorporated into WIPO. You know, that's another thing is that when you have these agreements, that sometimes the agreements make requirements upon the member countries to make changes to their own laws. So if the U.S. were to sign on to something that, you know, required us to change what we think of as fair use, that's something that would have serious effects to U.S. law. It's not just about, you know, what can be enforced in other countries. You know, these agreements can have real impact on our domestic law here.
Sure. Because where I was going with that is there's something to be said about maybe we have the benefit. It depends on how you look at it, either the benefit or the burden of having lived with the DMCA and Section 512 and all that stuff for, you know, a dozen years or so now. So maybe there's more of incentive for, you know, big content industry to keep it secret because, you know, when WIPO was going on, we didn't know the practical effects of the DMCA. And I'm not coming out saying that it's all bad. You know, there are good parts about the notice and takedown and safe harbor provisions, and there are bad parts about it as well. But it certainly is much more controversial now that we actually know about it and have seen it in practice than what you know, the notice and takedown provisions and the safe harbor provisions were when it, you know, went by the name OCILA, what was it, the Online Copyright Infringement, whatever act, you know, that was enacted and became the safe harbor provisions. There's the benefit or the burden, if you will, of hindsight at this point.
And, wow, and so now I feel like we have to get a constitutional scholar on the show to talk about the extent to which a treaty can come in and undo the decisions of U.S. legislators and courts, which it sounds like it perhaps has the authority to do. We'd wind up with yet another constitutional challenge and perhaps another case where the judge wants to put the trial on YouTube. with that, thank you so much, both of you, for being on the show, and Colette as well. We need to wrap it up for this week, but we'll be back next week, same time. No one has bumped us from our time slot. Thank you, Twit.
Yes.
we're happy to be here. And David, it's really great to have you on the show. I'd love to have you back sometime.
Thank you so much. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Cool. And where can people find you online when they're not listening?
Sure. Well, I contribute weekly to the Citizen Media Law Project blog. So that's at citmedialaw.org/blog. Also, we have the technicallylegal.org, which is sort of personal website, and I do it with two other colleagues. We do a weekly podcast that will come out every Tuesday. And additionally, we do blog posts on there. You can also find me on Twitter at D_O'Brien, O-B-R-I-E-N, without the apostrophe.
Great. Thank you so much for all your insights. And Evan, it's always a pleasure chatting with you. I see the holiday whiskers have gone by the wayside in the new year.
Yeah, that's right. I had to fulfill, you know, my obligations, or had to meet the conditions subsequent to allowing me to grow it. My wife says I can grow it if I promise to shave it before New Year's. So I had to live up to my promise on that. So, but great to be back. Thanks for having me. I thought it was a great discussion today. It gets better every time.
Yeah, it's fun. And we have a lot of fun links that we didn't get to. So we'll try and save those for next week. In the meantime, you can find Evan at internetcases.com and at internetcases on Twitter. You can find me at bagandbaggage.com. You can email me, denise@twit.tv. You can check out the Facebook page for the show, denise.howell.net/FB, where before the show I try and post questions where I'd love to get people's input on and share your responses on the show. And you can follow me on Twitter @dhowell. And I look forward to seeing you all next week and joining you then. Thanks very much.
See you later.
Bye-bye.